Summer of Fear. We are indebted to Colleen L. Rees and the Pacific Press Publishing Association of Idaho, America, for the copyright for this book. Your honorary reader is Muriel Ferris. The author's note is that the events in this story are true and occurred in the lives of real people in the Cascade Mountains in Washington State. The names of the people and towns have been changed, but the story is a good one.
Section 1.
Chapter 1. Jack's New Job. Jack Montgomery stepped inside the kitchen door and slumped against the frame. His usually untroubled blue eyes were clouded and his curly brown hair messed up. "No luck." Mrs. Montgomery deftly removed an apple pie from the oven. She sprinkled sugar over the top, making it look something like the grey sprinkled through her brown hair. Her blue eyes, like her son's, shone sympathetically. "None." Jack dropped to a chair and gazed unseeingly out the polished window. Tall fir and pine trees waved gently against a turquoise late May sky, the kind of day Jack loved best. It was a welcome contrast to the exceptionally rainy season that had plagued Snowden in the Cascade Mountains of Washington late that spring. Jack sighed and looked back at his mother. For the first time, he noticed the tiny worry lines around her eyes, the slight tenseness of her mouth. His heart sank. If only he could have brought home better news. "Maybe something will come up tomorrow," she said. "That's like Mom," Jack thought, "always looking ahead for a better day." His face filled with bitterness. "I just don't understand it," he said. "God knows how badly I need a summer job. School and clothing expenses just keep going up and up, and after the long winter shutdown, when Dad can't log, we need the money." "I know. Rocking chair unemployment compensation is hard to stretch." Mrs. Montgomery admitted the hard times. For a moment she looked defeated, but her cheerful smile soon crept out again. "At least we've had enough to eat this year and no one has been sick." "Yeah." But Jack wasn't all that convinced. "What did the mill owner say?" Jack tipped his chair back until it squeaked in protest. "He said I was too young. Not that I wouldn't be a good worker, but that he just couldn't use me." He felt the dull red colour creep into his face, but he met his mother's eyes squarely. "I told him I needed the job to help with school expenses." Mom's eyes gleamed with pride, but she only asked, "What did he say?" Jack's mouth twisted. "Oh, he was swell about it. He said, 'Son, I'd like to help you out, but I can't. I've got 2 openings and 15 men begging for jobs. The lumber business isn't what it could be. And Jack, those 15 men are heads of families. Most of them have several kids. They need money to put food on their tables.'" The mill owner sort of swallowed hard and then added, "It hurts to see their eyes when I tell them there's no work. Every one of them is a hard worker, same as you are, and I can't do a thing." "He must really have liked you to open up like that," Mom said quietly. "I know." Jack spread his hands out. "It's just that it was my last chance. None of the stores need anyone. The wives are competing for what few clerking jobs there are. I wanted to be able to tell Dad I had a job and could take care of my own expenses this year." "Dad appreciates what you're trying to do." Mom wiped her hands on the dish towel and brushed flour from her apron. The blue and white kitchen was a good setting for her. Their old-fashioned home had high ceilings and enough room for a rocker in the kitchen. How many childish troubles had Jack brought to her there? He felt a stinging in his eyes and shook his head hard. He was too old to cry over something he didn't get. Well, I've got to start supper. Mom smiled at him again. She'd been pretty when she was young. All the pictures showed that. But she was pretty now, too. Jack hugged her and grabbed the potato peeler. He could at least help with supper. There was no sign of his sister Mary, and Mom looked tired. While he peeled potatoes, his mind raced, frantically trying to figure out a new angle for getting a job. Mom's voice interrupted his thoughts. Have you prayed about it? That's always your answer, isn't it? Why not? It works. Jack couldn't help laughing at her quick retort. I don't see how God's going to make a job out of thin air and mountains. He pointed out the open door to the sunshine on Avalanche Peak and reflecting off the snow-capped mountains surrounding Snowdon. Don't give up. She impulsively ruffed his hair. God has a way of waiting until the last minute, then coming through with something better than we could ever hope or dream. That night, Jack sat on the step, thinking about what his mother had said. He'd been a Christian since he was a kid. He knew God could do anything. The question was, would he? It didn't look like it as May ended. June swept in hot and unexpectedly dry. The school was over for the year. Jack was cleaning out his locker when his friend Bill Arnold motioned mysteriously and led him to a deserted classroom. Bill's brown eyes snapped with excitement. Have you got a job yet? No, was all Jack could get out. Why? I got on with the Forest Service for the summer. Yeah? I wish I'd thought to ask sooner. Jack's spirits dropped, as if he just hadn't waited so long, if he'd only gone in when Bill first mentioned it. It mightn't be too late. Scuttlebutt has it that they may need another guy for tree planting and stuff. Bill couldn't keep back his excitement. Get yourself down there before any of the other guys hear about it. A thrill shot through Jack. I will, thanks. He gripped Bill's arm. Forget it, Bill grinned. You're all right, even if you are religious. He ducked Jack's mock swing and headed into the hall. Jack sprinted the mile to Forest Service headquarters, his heart pounding in time with his feet. It was the last minute, all right. Had God really made a job out of thin air and mountains, as he had joked? An hour later, Jack was running a mower over the lawn in front of the Forest Service building, wanting to yell with every blade of grass he cut. He had a job, at least for the month of June. Regular work would start the next day, but he'd ask if there was anything he could do to help that afternoon, and was given the mowing job. By quitting time, he had finished all except one area. He eyed it, disliking the idea of leaving it. Tomorrow he'd go out tree planting. There would be no time to finish the lawn. 20 minutes later, Jack had only a few swathes left. He turned a corner and saw the district ranger marching towards him. Jack didn't know the new ranger, but he looked stern. Oh, had he blown the job already? He shut off the mower as the ranger stopped a few feet away. What do you think you're doing? Jack's heart dropped down into his boots. Cutting the grass. Could have kicked himself for giving such a dumb answer. Didn't you hear the whistle? It's past quitting time. We don't pay overtime unless we authorize it ahead of time. The ranger scowled. I didn't expect overtime, Jack stammered, wiping his hot forehead. I was so close to being done I couldn't see leaving it, especially when I won't be here tomorrow to finish. Why not? Going swimming or something? No, tree planting. And you wanted to finish the job even in your own time? Yes. To Jack's amazement, the grim face broke into a smile. A hard hand shot out and the ranger said, Put her here. First day with us? Yes, but not the last. It popped out before Jack could stop it. He shook hands with the craggy-faced man. Welcome aboard. What's your name anyway?
Jack Montgomery.
Well, Jack Montgomery, you keep up your attitude and you won't have any trouble. The big ranger walked away with Jack staring at him. That night at supper, Jack told what had happened. He finished. I thought I'd had it when he yelled at me. His sister Mary, a miniature Mrs. Montgomery, looked solemn. I'd have been scared. Dad laughed. The ranger's all right. He carries a tremendous responsibility, not just for a smooth-running outfit, but for the safety of every crew member and even for Snowden. A frown marred his deep blue eyes, and he impatiently brushed back his brown and grey hair that curled like Jack's. Forecasters are predicting the driest summer ever for this area. Fire danger will be extreme come July and August. The town won't catch fire, will it? Mary shivered. Not as long as the Forest Service has good men to protect us. Dad's twinkling eyes didn't hide how proud he was that Jack had a job. Jack yawned. I think I'll hit the sack early. Big day tomorrow. Jack was right. It was a big day, and an exhausting one. Along with Bill and a dozen others, he rode the Forest Service crew bus to a logged-off area. The hillside that had held giant trees now lay empty in the sunlight. The fall before, the logging crew had done their required clean-up, burning down limbs and debris. Now the Forest Service crew would plant hundreds of seedling trees, and in time there would be new timber for homes and industry. Jack and Bill quickly demonstrated their skill to their straw boss, supervisor, who set them planting while he patiently showed the out-of-town boys how to hit the soil, make a gash in the earth and push in a seedling. A careful patting in, and the little tree was ready to grow. Glad we already know how to use a Pulaski. Bill lifted a tool that looked like a single-hit axe with an arched hoe extending from the back. Me too, Jack said. All that experience on tree planting day when we were at college is paying off. Jack expertly drove his Pulaski into the ground again. How many trees are we going to plant today? A whole lot. Bill pointed to the stacks of seedlings. Remember when we were sophomores, how some of the kids got tired and dropped bunches of seedlings in one hole? I bet some of these guys will too. By the end of the week, Jack saw some of the workers doing just that, but he refused to have a part of such negligence. He was being paid to do a good job. He'd give it all he had. Chapter 2, Mountain Rescue. A few days later, Jack and Bill had been planting trees for a couple of hours when the straw boss rushed up to them all out of breath. We need you two. One of the men on the survey crew slipped on a steep hillside several miles from here and drove a jagged wooden stake into his leg. He's bleeding badly and we need extra help packing him out. That 5-mile climb was the worst torture Jack had ever known. The mountain trail seemed to go straight up, and Jack found himself struggling after the first mile. Bill wasn't much better off. These regular employees are mountain goats, he groaned as he watched the straw boss and 5 other men scramble up the mountain ahead of them. Jack didn't have the wind to answer. Time and again he had to dig his cork boots into the mountainside to keep from sliding backwards. The day was hot, but ice water ran in his veins when he looked back. One slip and he knew he could be the next victim packed out. He gritted his teeth, said a silent prayer, and kept climbing. The surveyor's eyes were filled with agony when the rescue team finally arrived. Blood ran from his lips where he had bitten them to keep from screaming. Jack's eyes travelled to the blood-stained bandaged leg. He was horrified to see the large stob still embedded in the flesh. For a moment he thought he would be sick. They don't dare take it out, Bill whispered as the older men strapped the injured man on a canvas stretcher. He'd bleed to death. Jack looked at Bill, at the stretcher, and down the next to impossible pitch of the mountain they had climbed. Even with 8 men, it would take a miracle to get everyone out alive. It had been bad enough on the way up. How could they ever carry a stretcher back down? Fear, like something alive, clawed at his throat. He couldn't do it. Why had God let him have a job that might end in tragedy? Too scared to speak, he glanced at Bill. His friend was green. If you've ever prayed hard, make it now, Bill said. His eyes went back to the securely bound man. We're going to need every bit of help we can get. A few minutes later, the leader tightened the last strap around the injured man. We're ready, men. Six of us will carry the stretcher at a time. The other two will spill off. Jack and Bill stepped forward and grasped the crude stretcher. The injured man was tall, muscular, and heavy. Inch by inch they groped for footing. 100 times his feet slipped on the loose gravel, and Jack's heart leaped into his throat. He found that the only way to lick the fear was to concentrate on the stretcher and not look down. Time after time someone slid. Jack's arms felt as if they were being torn from their sockets. He and Bill were no match for the seasoned crew, but they kept up. They had to. Jack wasted no energy talking when it was his turn to be relieved. He saw the fine white line around the patient's lips and was glad when, after a harsh jolt of the stretcher, the man fainted. Was it hours or eternities when they reached the crew bus and were driven into town? Jack didn't know. Every bone in his body ached. The straw boss told Jack and Bill to go home, take long hot baths and soak out some of the soreness. He looked at them and smiled. I'm proud of you two. The doctor says he won't lose his leg, but he could have if he'd been much longer without medical attention. He's proud. We're beat, Bill muttered. Jack noticed the faint smile on his friend's face and knew he felt the same way. Jack was almost too tired to eat supper. I was so scared. I knew I'd never make it, he said after recounting the day's frightening events at the supper table. I wondered how come God let me get in such a tight spot. Was it because I wanted a job so bad? He winced as he reached for another biscuit. Coming down that mountain, there wasn't anywhere to go but straight down. Dad cleared his throat. I'd say it takes a big man to keep going when he's scared all the way through. I'd also say it takes a big God to keep people safe in that sort of danger. That's what Bill said. Jack closed his eyes for a second, remembering. He told me when we got back that he was glad I had an in with God. He had the feeling we'd be okay because of it. Maybe you were given the job for several reasons, Mum said. One of them may have been the chance to witness to Bill that accepting Jesus makes a real difference. Maybe. Jack was too worn out to pursue the idea, so he stumbled to bed and slept straight through the night. Time to get up, Jack, his mother called. It seemed to Jack that he had barely crawled between the sheets. He put his feet over the edge of the bed and started to sit up. Ow, I can't move! His body fell back onto the bed. You can't be late, Mum said. She handed him his clothes and boots. By the time he got to the compound, he felt a little bit better, but he was still stiff. Bill hobbled towards him. You too? Jack wanted to laugh. His friend looked even stiffer than he did. No tree planting for you today, their boss told him. You can go out with the campground crew today. Great, Bill grinned. I'm not sure I could lift a Pulaski, let alone plant a tree. The next several days went fast. Jack liked the comradeship of the fellows he worked with. Several were older students from other states who had come to Snowdon for jobs. There was always something going on. One day when Jack looked for his lunch sack, he found that it had been moved. He caught one of the older guys grinning and knew it was a trick. There was never anything harmful, just fun. Jack reached for his lunch. The sack rustled. Jack's hand froze in midair. His lunch sack was hopping. Another look at the grinning boy and Jack pounced on the sack. The top fell open. Out jumped an indignant frog. Its frightened eyes darted about for a few seconds, and then it took three flying leaps and disappeared into the forest. Its kidnappers rolled on the ground with laughter, and Jack laughed with them. But sometimes Jack couldn't laugh. He liked his fellow workers. He enjoyed fun and teasing. He didn't like the dirty jokes most of them told on the crew bus. He had been raised to think clean. Some of their little stories were sickening. What could he do? Should he just say right out how he felt? Bill must have noticed how quiet Jack always got when the joke started. Bill laughed, but he didn't join in all that much. One night he asked, "Are the guys getting to you?"
"Yeah."
Jack was glad to have it out in the open. "I like them, but I can't take their filthy jokes."
"They're just blowing off. Forget them."
"It's not that easy when you're right in the middle of it." Jack looked straight at Bill. "I sure don't claim to be perfect, but that kind of talk is rotten. Some of the other guys probably don't like it either, but they don't say anything."
"Want to sit up front? The worst jokes are at the back."
Bill's solution helped, but one day a raucous story with loud laughing got to Jack.
"Hold down the air pollution, will you?" he hollered. "Not all of us like it."
The laughter broke off in the middle. Then someone called back.
"What's wrong? Aren't you man enough to appreciate good humour?"
Jack's anger rose, but he controlled it.
"I'm man enough to know the difference between good humour and garbage."
Bill chimed in. "He's also man enough to plant his trees, not bury bunches and goof off." Someone laughed. Everyone knew the joker was guilty. Bill drawled, "Besides, you've told all your jokes so many times they are growing moss." Another boy agreed. "That's right. I'm tired of them too. Seems like you could keep them to a dull roar."
"Sissies."
But the speaker subsided when Bill gave him a cold stare. No one had messed with Bill after he grabbed one guy and pitched him into the creek for mouthing off.
"Thanks," Jack whispered.
"For what?" Bill grinned back at him. "You're the one who started it. I just got in at the end." Jack caught the respect in Bill's face. Maybe Mom had been right about his responsibility to Bill. "There's one thing about it," Jack told his family. "This job certainly isn't boring. There's lots of variety."
"Like what?"
Mary never tired of hearing about Jack's adventures. Jack counted them off on his fingers. "We built trails last week. Then we cleaned and repaired campgrounds." And his face darkened. "You won't believe the vandalism campers do. We found tables used for firewood when there were piles of wood there for the cutting. Some people are too lazy to work a little, so they grab whatever's not nailed down. This week we're rebuilding little log bridges on the trails. The spring floods took a lot of them out. When that's done, we'll lay pipes so water from the mountain streams can be piped into the campgrounds." He flexed his muscles. "I'm in a lot better shape than I've ever been before." He got serious. "It's a good thing. Bill and I have to help pack a lookout fire watcher's supplies into Avalanche Peak for the summer. It's 9 miles, and Bill said where we climbed to get the surveyor out was nothing compared to this."
Dread filled his face.
"I just hope we can do it. We'll be carrying 30-pound packs of supplies. It won't be any Boy Scout outing." Chapter 3, Avalanche Peak. The sun was barely up when Bill, Jack, and 6 older, tougher Forest Service employees parked the government small bus at the foot of the narrow, winding trail leading up to Avalanche Peak. Jack craned his neck and peered up to the small bump on top that was the lookout station. He breathed deeply and shot an apprehensive glance at Bill, who grimaced. It was going to be rough. Surprisingly, the first mile wasn't too bad. The incline was gentle, and Jack's cork boots, that means boots with spikes on them, bit into the needle-strewn forest floor. The spongy trail reminded him of a thick brown carpet. "Funny," he told Bill, "people always say they walk on pine needles. Washington forests are mainly fir trees." He measured the height of the lightning-scarred Douglas firs along the trail. "They make a guy feel pretty small, don't they?"
"Uh-huh."
Bill shifted his pack and a broad grin spread over his face. "The way the ranger trots up this trail makes me feel small." He nodded towards the erect back of the ranger in charge.
"I know what you mean. My pack's getting heavier, but he carries his like it was filled with chicken feathers."
"It isn't," Bill grinned again. "I hefted it before we started, and I'm telling you it's loaded but good. The vegetation along here is neat, isn't it?"
He brushed a sallow bush back from the edge of the trail.
Yeah.
Jack's quick glance took in the almost round, glossy, dark green leaves of the waist-high shrubbery with its dusty, black, berry-like fruit. This stuff only grows about a foot high in the sun, but look at it here. And Dad says he's seen it 8 to 10 feet tall.
I like the Oregon grape, Bill said, pointing to a sturdy plant. Still a few blooms, too. The yellow flowers contrasted with its shiny green leaves.
Enjoy it while you can, one of the older men called back with a meaningful grin. You won't be looking at the scenery for long.
They're doing fine, the ranger commented as he paused at a bend in the trail. His clear eyes reminded Jack of the eyes of a great eagle he'd once seen. All right, men, let's hit the second mile. The second mile wound up around corners, doubled back on itself and grew steeper. Jack's pack weighed his shoulders down as he bent a bit forward, and the third mile made him glad for all the training he and Bill had gone through on planting and other duties. The trail had been washed out in places, and the eight-man crew had to creep across rough ground that was littered with fallen rocks and slippery with needles. A rivulet of icy water ran across the way in one place. Jack leaped across it with the others, then turned back and splashed his face, taking refreshment from its chill.
You okay, buddy? A seasoned crew member asked.
Okay, Jack said, but he was relieved when the ranger called a rest stop at the next fairly level spot on the trail, before it ascended in tortuous switchbacks into the next mile. Somewhere in that next mile, Jack forgot the scenery, the destination, everything except the need to put down one foot and then another. He never looked down. He just squirmed under the pack straps and kept climbing. He no longer talked to Bill. He needed every breath of air for climbing. When he rested against the roots of a giant tree that had been toppled by storms, he took small sips from his canteen of water and thought of Dad's advice. Over the years, bits and pieces gleaned from working in the woods had been passed down to his family on their outings. Now he could almost hear Dad's firm voice. Look across, not down, when you're in a tough spot. It's better to keep moving, no matter how slowly, than to stop and have to start again. When you're winded, pant like a dog. If your mouth is dry, put 2 or 3 tiny clean stones in your mouth to make saliva flow. And finally, when you're at a turn where the trail goes higher, and you think you can't make it the rest of the way, turn around and see how far you've come. Jack followed the suggestions, amazed that they really did help. The most help was picturing Dad's pride over a job well done. Left, right, left, right, Jack doggedly marched in time with his thoughts. 4 miles, 5. His back was breaking. 6 miles. Could a person's lung burst from exertion, he wondered. He could hear Bill's laboured breathing behind him. 7 miles. They felt like 70. Why did the marker posts seem to be getting so much farther apart?
We'll stop just over the next ridge, the leader called.
How can he look so fresh, Jack thought. He felt like his strongest deodorant had worn off hours before. With a mighty burst of effort, he forced his tired legs to top the ridge, and he stopped so suddenly that Bill ran into him.
What's the big idea?
Dishevelled, panting, Bill was in no mood for jokes. Jack pointed with his finger. Look! Cuddled in a wide valley, surrounded by lush grass, lay the bluest lake Jack had ever seen.
Hey, is that for real?
Bill rubbed his eyes. Whoopee!
Weariness forgotten, he raced down the slight incline with Jack in hot pursuit. Moments later, their packs on the ground, the boys hit the water together. Their yells split the air as the ice-cold water chilled their hot, sweaty bodies. Jack headed for the shore, and even the intrepid Bill stayed only for a few minutes.
Brrr! Teeth chattering, Jack stood in the warm sun that had made him so miserable while climbing, but now provided heat for his shivering body.
Why didn't you tell us there was a lake? And why is it so cold? I've never seen such a beautiful light. Bill wrapped his arms around his body. Neither had Jack. The lake lay in a hollow, a sapphire surrounded by emerald grass. Indian paintbrush flowers and other colourful blooms Jack couldn't identify. He almost missed the lead ranger's answer. We knew you'd be surprised. It's freezing cold because it's a glacier lake, see? He waved a lean, tanned hand to a smooth expanse of ice mass at the far side of the lake. No wonder it's cold, Jack exploded. Does that glacier ever melt? Not unless it's unusually hot summer, the ranger said. Even then only parts of it melts. The core remains frozen. Bill laughed. Wish we had this lake back near Snowdon. It's just too far away to get up and see it often. He looked at the ranger. By the way, what's its name? It's called Nameless Lake, the ranger said. It's an odd name, Jack mused. He looked at the lake, the bright flowers, the white glacier in the distance. It's worth the climb, he said. The good Lord has a way of tucking beautiful things away where it takes some effort to get them, the ranger said quietly. Jack looked at Bill. He could detect nothing but agreement in his flushed face. The packs seemed to have shrunk to their normal weight when the crew shouldered them again. Jack looked longingly back to Nameless Lake as they mounted the ridge on the other side. But Bill's wow turned him back to the trail. His mouth fell open. Before him loomed Avalanche Peak, rising practically straight up. Its rugged face and frowning side sent a wave of terror up and down Jack's spine. How will we get the supplies to the top? Bill asked the question that trembled on Jack's lips. The answer only increased Jack's fear. Simple. We carry them, the ranger said. Up there? There isn't any trail. Jack licked his lips. His mouth felt like it was filled with sawdust. How could even a mountain goat get up a perpendicular mountain like Avalanche Peak? From where they stood, it seemed to rear into the sky as straight as the biggest trees the crew had passed on their climb. Wait until we get to the bottom, their leader advised. It won't seem so straight up and down from there. Jack shook his head. Help us to make it, Lord, he whispered. The final 2 miles from the lake to the end of the trail weren't too steep, but to Jack the walk across the valley was filled with dread. The long grass and flowers gave way to sloping rock slides, and the crew had to pick their way around jagged boulders. At the base of the mountain, the ranger stopped them. Jack looked up, squinting against the sun. Avalanche Peak wasn't straight up and down, but it was filled with small crevices. Stunted trees clung to its sides. The actual peak had been blasted off to make room for the lookout, and jagged boulders and rocks lay just beneath it. Follow me, the ranger ordered. Clutching the side of an outcropping for support, he eased his way forward along a faint trail that had been invisible only a short distance away. The others followed. Jack panted and strained. He was glad for the huge rocks on either side of the path to which he could cling. This isn't a mountain, he protested half under his breath, ashamed to let even Bill know how he dreaded what surely lay around the next rock or the next. Mountains have trees, he muttered. This is just a big pile of rock. Just when Jack knew matters could get no worse, they did. Hot, sweaty and scared, he and Bill climbed onto a ledge where the other six rested. Jack turned, looked across the valley and gulped. The valley floor seemed to be straight down with nothing but empty space in between. They clung to the rock like leeches. Wow! Bill gulped into Jack's ear. What a place for Custer's last stand. Jack caught the awestruck look on his friend's face and felt better. Even his churning stomach settled a little, knowing that Bill was scared too. Yeah, or Geronimo, or Cochise, or Hey, I never knew the state of Washington had strongholds like this. Think what might have happened if the Apaches had been here instead of Arizona. He managed a feeble grin. Okay, men, the lead ranger stood up. It's a little tricky from here on. He paused to scan the distances between them and the top, and Jack exchanged glances with Bill. A little tricky, he thought. What would the ranger call what they'd already done? A Sunday walk? You can see that we still have a major climb, and in some places there's only a rut in the rock or a slim ledge. What we have to do is hang onto the ropes that have been firmly fastened into the cliff and feel our way around and up, then swing the rope back for the next man. If Jack had been scared before, he now felt petrified. God, I didn't ask for Mount Everest, he thought. But he never took his eyes off the ranger, who reached for the first rope. The ledge on which they had been sitting kept getting narrower. The ranger cautiously put one foot onto the ledge, then the other, and literally walked up a 50-foot section of the cliff. Reaching a little wider spot, he swung the rope back. Next! Jack and Bill stared at each other. Jack was tempted to turn and flee. There is no way I can go up that mountain clinging to a rope, he said through his chattering teeth. Bill looked scared too, but the next moment he said, I'll go next. Jack held his breath as his friend started out. The rocks under Bill's feet shifted and he stopped. Then he was with the leader, beckoning Jack to follow him. God help me, Jack prayed. I can't be a quitter. His silent cry for help steadied him. He took the rope and stepped forward and up. Instantly, the heavy pack threw him off balance. Terror wiped out his courage. Lean forward, the men below shouted. Jack obeyed and gradually lost the feeling of being tipped over. Somehow he made it up the 50-foot rock face and sank beneath an outcropping. His fingers felt cramped. The ranger grabbed Jack's shoulder. See, it isn't so bad. Jack smiled weakly. It was a mystery to him how the others could keep from hearing how fast his heart was pounding. Bill seemed to have regained some of his daring. Any more places like this? He asked. Just two more, the ranger replied. The words had been meant as reassurance. Instead, they sent chills up and down Jack's spine. He involuntarily glanced down and wished he hadn't. The jagged rocks beneath him were like teeth in a dragon's mouth. There was very little to keep any of them from tumbling hundreds of feet. If someone fell, he would be torn to pieces. His stomach lurched and he sent another silent prayer into the blue sky. The prayer seemed to help him make it across the next two rope holds in the uneven spiral walk around the peak. In no time, though in another way it seemed like an eternity, Jack grasped Bill's hands and bounded onto the flat surface at the top of Avalanche Peak. The air was thinner and he breathed great gulps in order to satisfy his lungs. Gradually his brain cleared and he became more aware of his surroundings. Never in his life had he stood on top of a mountain and looked across at neighboring peaks. Why, it's a whole different world up here, he exclaimed. It was a new world. Jack looked down at a river that looked more like a thread. The smaller mountains and valleys looked like humps and slight depressions. He decided that a pocket-sized blue circle must be Nameless Lake. The voices of the others faded, and for an instant Jack felt as though he had been permitted to see the earth from God's point of view, fresh and unpolluted by people. He gazed for a long time before following the others into an odd little building perched on top of Avalanche Peak. Neat, isn't it? Bill slipped out of his pack and let it fall to the floor of the little house. It sure is. Jack looked around the room where in a few days someone would come to live for the rest of the summer. It was compact, equipped with instruments to scan and chart smoke and fires. Lonely, though, he said. You can see forever. Bill glanced out the big window set in wood walls. And look at this, a glass chair. That's for lightning. That's for lightning storms, the ranger said. The lookout sits in that chair. It's not grounded. It can get pretty spooky with blue lightning dancing in here, but it's safe. The ranger began stowing away the supplies from his pack. The other men quickly shed their packs, and Jack straightened and stretched as his landed on the floor with a resounding thump. At least the fire watcher will be well supplied, one of the men grunted. Jack silently agreed. Someone would make use of everything they had lugged up the mountain. Imagine going down that untrail for water. Bill hunched his shoulders. Not me, Jack said with a shudder. If he ever got off Avalanche Peak, it would be enough for him. He might hike back into Nameless Lake sometime, but not up to the lookout. It took more willpower and silent prayers to get down. Bill slipped once and slid a few feet before his hold on the rope stopped him. Freckles Jack hadn't ever seen before popped out against Bill's chalky skin, but he didn't say a word. They ate lunch by Nameless Lake, and the boys took another dip before heading home. Going downhill with empty packs was a pleasure after their climb. The experts say hiking downhill is harder than going up, but it's sure a lot less scary, Bill exclaimed. The weary crew finally reached the main camp. They stacked their empty packs in a shed, and Jack and Bill were just getting ready to leave for the day when the ranger stopped them. I almost forgot, he said. The district ranger wants to see both of you before you go home tonight. He pointed through a group of trees to a large building 100 or so feet away. Over there, he said. He's waiting for you. Chapter 4. Suppression School. Jack and Bill stumbled through the trees and stepped cautiously into the district ranger's office. The stern face across the desk didn't seem to relax even a tiny bit. Jack's mind raced. Had they done something wrong? He couldn't think of anything that might call for a conference. He glanced at Bill and saw that he was just as bewildered. "Sit down, fellows," the ranger said. Jack and Bill took two chairs that sat near each other in front of the ranger's desk. The ranger cleared his throat. "I've been hearing about you boys." Jack's heart sank. After all they'd gone through, they had done something wrong. He should have been too tired to care, but he wasn't. He desperately wanted to hold on to his job. "Reports have come in from each of your supervisors." Jack looked at Bill in despair as the ranger shuffled papers. This was it. They were going to be let go. Bitterness began to creep over him. "All reports are excellent." "What did you say?" Bill jumped from his chair. Jack just sat there, unable to believe his ears. "Word gets back," the ranger said. "Supervisors aren't blind." He cleared his throat. "For example, we know who plants trees and who doesn't. We also know who doesn't whimper when given extra work like climbing mountains." Jack's jaw dropped, but the ranger wasn't through. "So when it comes time to pick men to attend suppression school, we remember." He stood and shoved his chair back, reached across the desk and shook hands with them. "You'll be going to Stonedale next week for 3 days. A smile lit his face. "You've earned it." An hour later, Jack burst through the front door. "Dad, Mum, Mary, guess what?" He fairly flew into the kitchen. "I'm going to suppression school. You know, where they teach firefighting and advanced stuff." He took a deep breath, and it's because Bill and I did our jobs even when some of the other guys goofed off. "The Bible says that he who is faithful in little things will be given bigger things," Mom said. Her blue eyes sparkled. Dad grinned. "That's right. Although some of the mountains you've conquered this summer can't really be called little things." The weekend passed swiftly. Monday morning, Bill picked Jack up early. It was a 2-hour drive from Snowdon to Stonedale, and they didn't want to be late. The place was crawling with people when they arrived. Someone showed them to the dormitory. The boys picked cots next to each other and stowed their gear.
It was the beginning of a great experience.
Section 2.
About 40 boys had been sent from the various ranger districts. They were expected to learn, but there were a lot of other highlights, such as terrific food, horseshoe, volleyball and other games. Jack laughed at his awkward horseshoe pitches at first, but compared with the city boys, as the ones outside the area were called, he wasn't all that bad. The daylight hours were jammed with classes. They learned safety, the use of tools, how to sharpen tools with a file, how to keep equipment in top shape. Jack especially enjoyed learning to read a compass. For the final test at suppression school, each student was sent into the forest on his own compass course to find a package hidden in the woods. The package represented a fire. Jack was confident he'd have no trouble. His keen sense of direction, along with the compass, should serve him well. The students were sent out at 5-minute intervals. Each was expected to find the fire, return to the camp, and describe what it looked like to his leader. Jack smiled as he read his instructions. A week before, the instructions on the page in his hand would have looked like some code. Now he understood exactly what to do. He read the first item, 270 degrees minus 300 yards. Piece of cake. They'd had fun measuring each other's strides the day before. He was tall enough that his normal stride was one full yard. He set his compass and carefully stepped off 300 yards. 190 degrees minus 45 yards. This was fun. Completing the last step, Jack found the fire and let out a yell. He carefully noted not only the appearance of the metal box, but its numbers and letters and what the woods around looked like. Then he struck out towards home base. The return trip was much shorter. The fire hunt had followed rough terrain, much of it under the trees. Jack set his compass and took a direct route back. Several students crowded around him when he entered the camp. Some still had not left on their trek. "Did you find it?" they asked. "Sure, it's easy when you know how." "Then why aren't some of the guys who went out first back yet?" "It's harder for some people," Bill said. "I understand that last year some of the guys wandered around all afternoon and finally the staff had to go after them." "Is that true?" one of the students asked. "Yeah," Bill's brown eyes danced with mischief. One of the city kids sidled up to Jack. Pete was the only one of the entire crew that Jack and Bill didn't like. Always bragging about how good he was at everything. He was big and bold and his language should have been buried. $10 if you'll give me a description of the fire," Pete whispered in Jack's ear. Jack shook his head. "Get your own description. Using a compass could save your life some day or the lives of others." "So I can beat you with a compass any time. I just don't feel like going on a dumb kiddie treasure hunt." "Sorry, Pete." Jack turned away. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Pete approach Bill and say something. Bill's "No way," brought a sullen look to Pete's face and a smile to Jack's, especially when Pete was the next one called. He didn't have time to ask anyone else for the description. Tired but successful, the students straggled in. A few frankly admitted that they hadn't found their fire. Pete was back in record time, gloating over how good he was. He took the time to inform Jack and Bill that he hadn't bought the description either. He acted surprised when Jack said, "Good for you." His arrogance slipped and a real smile crossed his face. "Love your enemies, it drives them crazy," Bill said half under his breath. Jack chuckled. Bill wasn't as rough and tough as he pretended. The drive home was beautiful. The lazy river that ran alongside the state road gave no sign that only a few months earlier it had been a raging flood. A coyote trotted along the road ahead of them. Flowers blossomed at the side just beyond the shoulder. "The quiet's kind of nice after these past few busy days," Jack remarked. Bill turned and looked at him. "If what I hear is true..." Suddenly he clamped a hand over his mouth. Jack bolted upright. "What did you hear?" he demanded. "I'm not supposed to pass it on. I heard talk, that's all." "Can't you even give me a hint? How did you happen to know anything anyway?" Bill looked mysterious.
I have ways. He sounded just so smug that Jack had to laugh. Bill spoke slowly. I can't repeat what I heard, but if it's true, he paused for dramatic effect, we will be getting plenty of quiet for the next couple of months. Jack shivered as Bill went on in a subdued voice, probably a whole lot more quiet than either of us wants. Chapter 5. Jack's Fear. More quiet than either of us wants? Bill's words haunted Jack. They beat in his brain and skipped through his dreams. They could mean just one thing. He and Bill were being selected to be lookout fire watchers during the hot season. His throat parched at the thought. It was an honour to be chosen. Only 5 fire watchers were used, 1 each for the 5 lookout stations in the vicinity of Snowdon. Jack mentally ticked them off. Avalanche Peak. He shuddered. Not that again. The others weren't so bad. Big Bear Mountain, Fur Mountain, and Indian Peak required climbing, but they were nothing like the Untrail, as Bill had called it, at Avalanche. Chinook Mountain was closer to town and had a temporary station until a new lookout could be built. There was a road full of switchbacks, rough and filled with chuck holes, but cars could get right into the station. I should be thrilled, Jack whispered to himself as he got ready for church the next day. It means work and the chance to keep on earning money. If I don't take it, there may not be any more work for me, and it isn't even the 1st of July. He smoothed his curly hair and forced himself to look into the blue eyes watching him from the mirror. They held no gladness. They held fear. Jack turned away. He felt disgusted with himself. Tears threatened to flood his eyes. He whirled back to the shadowy image in the mirror. Admit it, coward. You're afraid to stay alone on a lookout for 2 months. His blue eyes blazed back from the glass. Go on. When the district ranger calls you in and offers you the job, act like a baby. Tell him the truth, that you need and want the job, but you aren't going to take it. He swallowed a sob. Because you're scared of the dark. Jack threw himself on his bed, hating the hot tears that pushed through his eyelids. Jack's mind went back to the night years before, as a child, when someone had jumped out at him from the dark. Ever since he'd been afraid. Why couldn't he get over it? He'd tried so hard. Time after time he'd forced himself to walk home alone after basketball games and church activities, and hated every minute of it. Always there was a feeling of something unseen but horrifying, just waiting for the perfect opportunity to snatch him. He'd told himself 1,000 times that he was acting childish. It hadn't helped. He'd prayed about it a lot. Once he even asked Mom, "Why doesn't God hear and answer?" He wouldn't forget her answer. God doesn't always grant our wishes immediately or in the way we expect. Her hands covered with flour rested on the breadboard. Some people ask for patience, and several children come along, giving them the opportunity to learn patience. Could it be possible? Was this job God's answer, opening a way for him to learn courage? God had helped him on steep mountainsides. Wouldn't he also help him on a lonely peak? Jack's unanswered question rang in his mind all through church, together with a new one that had been added. If this was God's answer, was he man enough to accept it? He glanced at Dad, wishing he could be more like him. Dad was so solid. It was hard to think he'd ever tremble at the thought of doing anything. Jack sighed. It wasn't until Pastor Evans read the scripture that he settled down and really listened. When he did, his pulse bounced. It seems more than a coincidence that Pastor Evans had chosen this particular scripture. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord. Jack missed the rest of the reading. A warm feeling began to invade his cold fear. If the district ranger had asked him at that moment, he would have agreed to go wherever requested, even to Avalanche Peak. But during a conversation with some of the youth group after church, some of his doubts returned.
Andrea Thomas, their president, was making a list of those going to youth camp in a few weeks.
"I don't have to ask you, Jack."
Her shiny black hair shone in the sun. "You wouldn't miss camp for a million." She started to add his name to her list.
"Say, what about bringing Bill?"
Jack's new confidence shattered into such tiny fragments that not a pinpoint was left.
"I don't think I'll be going this year," he muttered.
Andrea's mouth opened in disbelief. Jack turned on his heel and pushed out of the crowd.
"What's wrong with Jack?" he heard her say as he hurried away.
He shut his ears and walked faster, but he couldn't outrun his resentment.
Why couldn't this have been like any other summer?
Hiking, biking, swimming. Youth camp. He grimaced. The rest he could give up, but missing youth camp? What a terrible idea. He didn't even have to close his eyes to see the sparkling lake, the circle of stones where they held campfires, the cross on the hill where they had special worship services. Every year, kids who went to camp accepted Christ in the beautiful spirit of love and friendship that existed there. He had hoped that Bill would go this year and see how much happier life was with Jesus as a trailmate. Instead, they'd both be stuck on some miserable lookout with no one to talk to except the birds and squirrels, if there were any goofy enough to live there.
"No."
Jack clenched his fist and stopped in the yard. "The sacrifice is too much. Even God won't expect me to give up the chance to lead Bill to him." He stopped. Would Bill turn down a job for a church camp? Jack stepped onto the porch.
"Even if he won't, I'm going to."
Now that he had decided, Jack felt better. Mom and Dad and Mary didn't even know he was being considered. He'd tell the district ranger he couldn't give up camp. Just maybe there was something else he could do until then. Jack reached for the screen door and froze. The front door was open and he could hear Dad talking inside. Jack had never heard his father so totally discouraged. "All we can do is trust the Lord. At least Jack has a job, so we'll get by. But why, after such a long winter shutdown, did this have to be the summer predicted for a drought? The woods will be closed much of the time. That means we'll do without all but the absolute necessities." Jack gulped. His dreams of camp died. He tiptoed back off the porch, set his jaw, and ran back up the steps, forcing a burst of enthusiasm. He jerked open the screen door and ran inside, pasting a phony smile on his face.
"Guess what?"
He pretended not to see Mom's tears and Dad's drawn face. "Wait until I tell you the rumor around the compound." By talking fast, he carried it off, in front of his parents. But that night he slipped back into the blackness and stared straight ahead, feeling trapped. There was no turning back now, no matter how much he feared the challenge ahead. The next Monday morning, Jack was glad that he was prepared when he and Bill were called into the ranger headquarters. Two other boys from suppression school were already there, Ed and Tom. A few minutes later, the door opened and Pete walked in.
"Hi, Pete."
Jack held out his hand, so did Bill.
"Hi. I see you got picked too, huh?"
A satisfied smile settled on Pete's face. "I knew I would. I'm the only city boy who was asked. They know who can take it." Bill made a face behind Pete's back.
"Same old braggart."
A little later, Jack was glad. It started when Ed said, "Do you know who is being assigned where?"
"No, but I sure hope I don't get Avalanche Peak," Jack said.
Bill's grin didn't hide his seriousness, and Jack knew he felt the same. Jack's prayers over the coming assignment had dwindled to a, "Please, God, not Avalanche Peak."
"What's so terrible about Avalanche Peak?" Pete sat up and his dark eyes glittered.
"If it isn't the worst climb in the world, it's got to be ahead of whatever's in second place," Bill told him.
"Are you guys too chicken to take it?" Pete taunted.
Bill studied the grinning, unpleasant face. Something danced in his eyes.
"I'll go if I'm assigned, but I'm sure not volunteering for it."
"Good, then I will."
"You're nuts," Jack protested. "You don't know what you..."
"Forget it," Pete glared at him. "You country hicks are enough to make me sick. always thinking you have to be born out here to be tough. I'm going to show you what kind of men come from the cities." Jack was silenced. If Pete had to prove himself, let him go. Besides, much as the others hated to admit it, he was good. He had excelled at practically every task at suppression school. Several minutes later, the five boys were seated in front of the district ranger's desk. He still looked tight-lipped and stern. The boys were silent. "You have been chosen because you have proved yourselves capable," he began. "Fire watching is a vitally important task. The safety of men in the woods, millions of board feet of lumber, and Snowdon itself are your responsibility." Even Pete looked impressed. For once his sullen face was light with anticipation. The ranger outlined their duties. They were important, though not overwhelming. Then he said, "About assignments." "Excuse me, sir." Was that Pete's respectable voice? Jack had time to wonder before Pete added, "If it's all right with you, I'd like to be assigned to Avalanche Peak." The ranger frowned. "I actually had Jack in mind for that post. I was going to put you on Chinook, at the temporary lookout. I'm not sure you..." "I'd really like to try." Pete's eyes glowed and Jack held his breath. He could almost feel his heart beating in his toes, where it had dropped when the ranger mentioned his assignment. Pete continued, "I can handle it." The ranger looked at Pete, then at Jack. "Well, if it is all right with Jack, I have no objection." Jack felt Bill's elbow dig in his ribs and mumbled, "It's okay." "Good. That means Pete on Avalanche, Ed on Big Bear, Bill on Indian Peak, Tom on Fur Mountain, and Jack on Chinook." He stood up, and the five trooped out. "See how easy it is to get what you want?" Pete couldn't help gloating. "All you gotta do is ask." Bill smiled mischievously. "Sure, Pete." On the way home, he said to Jack, "How'd you like the way I set Pete up and got you off the hook?" He turned a sharp corner and his mouth stretched into a laugh. "I heard from one of the rangers that one of us was picked for Avalanche because of the great job we did packing in supplies, so I figured out a way to get us free." He laughed again. "It worked, too." Relief mingled with a funny feeling, and Jack stared out the car window at Avalanche Peak several miles in the distance. "I just hope he's all right. He's used to city lights and noise. It can get pretty dark and lonely on the lookout." "I know," Bill hesitated. "I guess we'll have to get used to it." He changed the subject. "You're the lucky one, only about 18 miles from town. If it ever rains, you can get down. Wish Indian Peak were closer," he sighed. "Big deal. 18 miles might as well be 80. Once Dad takes me up in the pickup, I'm as isolated as Indian Peak. It takes wheels to travel, remember?" "No sweat. You may as well use my jalopy. I can't take it with me." Bill patted the wheel. "Don't want her feeling neglected." Jack brightened. With the jalopy and his little lookout house, things might not be so bad after all. At least God had answered his prayers and kept him off Avalanche Peak. With some help from Bill and Pete, or by using them. "Things are definitely starting to look up," he muttered. He groaned at his own pun, but he whistled after Bill left. Now, if God would just take away his fear of the dark, the summer would be all right after all. Chapter 6. Chinook Lookout. Jack hadn't realized how many things a person used in a month's time till he began setting aside what he'd need for his 2 month stint on top of the mountain. It took every spare corner of Bill's jalopy to carry all his things. "I'm glad it's Chinook and not Avalanche Peak," he exclaimed when they were through. "I couldn't possibly pack all that stuff to the top of Avalanche." An hour later, Mary climbed into the worn seat beside him, just as Jack turned the key in the switch. The jalopy's engines coughed once and then roared. Mum and Dad came out the front door. "We'll be right behind you in the pickup, but far enough back not to eat your dust," Dad called. Good. He watched as his parents got in the pickup that sat in the driveway ahead of the jalopy. He eased the jalopy onto the main road and headed towards the edge of town. Through the rearview mirror, he saw the pickup pull out of the driveway and follow them. A short distance out of town, they turned onto a secondary road that took them to the Chinook Mountain Cut-off, a primitive fire road that wound up to his summer home. Ouch! Mary rubbed her head where she'd banged it when she bounced up after the jalopy hit an unfilled chuck hole. Isn't a very good road, is it? She peered through the rolled down window. But the trees are pretty, and oh, look, there's a little brown rabbit. I can't look, Jack told her. I have to keep my eyes on the road. There probably won't be any other cars except ours and Dad's pickup, but there could be. Sometimes tourists go berry picking up here or sightseeing. He skillfully manoeuvred the jalopy around a hairpin turn, shifted into the lowest gear and chugged ahead. Sometimes the road was a green tunnel where alder branches met above the narrow track. At other places, curves doubled back on themselves. Mary held on tightly and watched for more animals. A clear creek ran down the side of the mountain and under the road through a culvert, splashing down a cliff on the other side. Just beyond the creek, they went up a steep incline and rounded the last bend and came into an open space. Jack strained to see his summer home. Mary's mouth made a red "Oh!" before she said in a disappointed voice, But where are the mountains and the pretty meadows and the lake and where's your little house? She pointed scornfully, Jack, what's that funny-looking thing? Jack could hear Dad's pickup slowing behind him, and he drove ahead until the road, if it could be called such, stopped. His chest hurt. What an awful place. A logged-off, naked hillside overlooked the valley. There were no green trees, only stumps, hundreds of them, and blackberry vines. Fireweed. What a contrast with the cozy hut, unobtainable Avalanche Peak lookout. Jack tried to hide his disappointment. It was nothing like what he had expected. I guess that funny-looking house, is my new home. He could feel a sick smile stretch across his face. Mary stared round-eyed. When Jack parked the jalopy, she didn't move. You are going to live in that? She sounded incredulous. It's weird. It's a tent frame. Dad and Mum had arrived. Jack watched Mum's shocked disbelief. Dad calmly surveyed the structure in front of them. It was about 8 feet square, with a board floor and 3-foot board uprights all around the side except at the door. A tent was stretched over the top. The canvas flaps on the door didn't quite meet, even when tied shut. Dad's blue eyes twinkled. Not quite the Hilton, is it? It's not so bad, Mum said as she stepped around inside. Here's a cot. The mattress is hard, but your sleeping bag's thick. See? You can put your books and stuff on this table. She turned around a couple of times, and dismay changed her determinedly cheerful voice. Where's your camp stove for cooking? Jack was disheartened, but not willing to show it. They're supposed to bring one up. Until then, I'll eat cold stuff. He grinned to keep back the disappointment over the surroundings. Good thing I brought plenty of canned spaghetti, cheese, and canned milk with cocoa. Cooking in the tent would be too hot anyway. Mom blinked hard. We'll come when we can, probably once every 2 weeks. Jack could see that it was as hard for her as it was for him. He could see the disappointment in her eyes. She went on. If it rains, you'll get down, won't you? You bet. He tried to make a big grin. Dad's keen eyes were on him, and he wasn't about to show yellow. Shall I pray for rain? That wouldn't be a bad idea at all, Dad agreed, although I believe everyone in Snowdon is already doing just that. For a moment, Jack felt ashamed. He'd prayed for a job, and God had sent him one. With so many people having so many troubles, his were insignificant. What difference did his problems make to God? but he mentally shook his head. He knew that wasn't true. Anything that bothered him was also of concern to God.
"You're sure close to God up here."
Mary looked around the bald knob and then suddenly pointed to the sky. "Hey, is that an eagle?" Jack forgot his misery long enough to admire the huge bird floating on an air current. "Boy, what a beauty. Look at that wing spread." "There are blue jays, too, and lots of crows." Mary inched closer to Jack. "Maybe they'll keep you company." Her anxious face showed him how much she cared.
"Boom!"
"What's that?" Mary demanded.
"Boom!"
The earth shook and settled. "There are loggers dynamiting about a mile from here," Jack told her.
"If you get too lonesome, you can go and visit them."
Jack shook his head. "I'll be too busy for that."
"So will they."
He messed up Mary's hair. "I'm here to work, not to goof off." The afternoon seemed to fly past. Finally, Dad said, "We have to go." He gripped Jack's hand. "I'm proud of you, son." Mist blurred Jack's vision. "Thanks, Dad." Mom had borrowed Jack's binoculars and was gazing over the valley. Snowdon was the only town within a 40-mile radius and invisible from where they stood. But silver ribbons showed where the rivers drained through the valley. Here and there cleared spots in the tall timber showed farms or homes outside of town.
"Jack, come here!"
Excitement rang in Mom's call. "Take the binoculars and look down there." She focused them. "No, more to the right. What do you see?" "A clearing, part of a brown building." He moved the glasses slightly. A small, bright patch. Blood pounded in his head. "Is it our place?"
"I'm sure it is. Let Dad use the binoculars."
Satisfaction crept over Dad's face. "That's home, all right."
"Let me see," Mary squealed, jumping up and down.
She finally managed to hold the glasses still enough to catch a glimpse of what Mom had spotted.
"That's the aluminium roof on our house, the one you put on to make the snow slide off."
"Good, now we can signal to Jack just like the people did in the olden times before there were telephones." For the first time since seeing his new summer home, Jack felt excited. "What a swell idea." His mind raced, planning ahead. "If you wave a white sheet in the clearing by the woodshed, it will tell me everything's okay. I can wave a white sheet back too."
"But how will we know when to wave?"
Mary's face puckered. Dad smiled and made his voice sound mysterious. "How about a Montgomery good night every evening at 6 o'clock? A rendezvous." "Great." But then Jack frowned. "Will I be able to see the sheet for the trees?" "We'll put it on a long pole," Dad promised. "And we'll wave every night," Mary added. "It will mean all is well, we love you, God bless, and good night," Mum said softly. Jack choked up for a second. He really was lucky to have such a special family.
"Hurry, Daddy," Mary could hardly wait to go. "We can wave to Jack tonight."
"It will have to be a 7 o'clock wave tonight," Dad said. "It's nearly 6 now, and going down that road and on home will take close to an hour." He smiled. "Jack has some going to do, too. Remember where that stream of clean water came over the ridge and through the culvert a little way back down the road? Jack will have to bring water from there for drinking."
"How's he going to have a bath?"
Jack turned red, but Dad just chuckled. "It's cold, but back up the road where the water pours from the culvert would make a great shower." Mary frowned. Dad laughed. "Don't worry, there's no danger of anyone seeing him. Few cars come up here. Besides, the brush and ferns pretty much hide his outdoor shower." Mary giggled. "Just like the pioneers, huh?" Mom, Dad, and Mary climbed into the pickup. Mary waved as they rounded the first sharp curve and drove out of sight. Jack could hear the pickup for a long time in the clear air, but at last the sounds of the motor died. He was alone. "I won't think about being alone," he said out loud. Instead, he took the car for water, thankful that Bill had lent him the jalopy. Packing water by foot, even enough for drinking water, up the hill would have been the last straw. Depression settled over Jack like a cloud. He tried to shrug it off, but it refused to go away even when he stood beneath his pioneer shower. He dried off with a towel and drove back to his makeshift home, careful to keep an eye on his watch. By 7 o'clock he had the tent filled with his gear. He picked up his binoculars and looked across the valley. Suddenly he saw a tiny white spot moving back and forth. His heart pounded. He grabbed his white sheet and waved it furiously. From the peaceful valley below came a vigorous answering wave. Jack watched until it gradually stopped, then disappeared. All was well with his family. His eyes smarted. What was he doing on this barren, lonely mountain with only a sky full of stars and the night wind for company? Never had he appreciated home so much. The games they played, the way they all worked to help each other, even the way he and Mary scrapped, arguing without meaning it. Something rustled in the darkness. Jack automatically raced for his tent and tied down the flaps. He lighted the big lantern with shaking fingers, listening hard, but he heard no more rustling. He reached for his Bible and tried to read. It was impossible. He blew out the lantern, crawled into his sleeping bag, and tried to get comfortable. But he lay stiff, knowing that he'd never be able to sleep. "I'll think of the good things," he breathed, but his own whisper seemed loud in the vast stillness. "It's a beautiful view down in the valley, across to other peaks and into the timber," he thought. "I've always loved birds, and now there are several kinds. I like flowers, too. So what if the stumps on the mountainside are ugly? They are almost covered with fireweed." He pictured the pink-purple sea of waving flowers. "It will never be too hot up here. There's a good breeze and it's high." Gradually his eyes closed. When he opened them, bright sunlight streamed through the ill-fitting tent flaps and he sat straight up. He had actually survived the first night. He stepped out into a clean, gorgeous day. He even hummed as he opened cans for a cold breakfast. If he could make it one day, he could make it another. Chapter 7. Cougar. Jack lived one day at a time for 3 days and nights, but on the fourth night he was wakened by low moans. He jerked up in bed. There they were again, low, sobbing cries, the saddest sounds Jack had ever heard, and the most terrifying, like the cry of a heartbroken woman or a little child. Jack knew what it was. Cougars cried that way. He felt like his blood was turning to ice. The water from the culvert would have been warm compared with the drops of sweat forming on his forehead. He tried to remember everything encouraging he had ever heard about cougars. They seldom attack people. They attack only when starving or cornered or protecting their young. "Leave them alone and they'll leave you alone," was Dad's advice. None of it helped. Jack couldn't help remembering the claws and teeth that cougars owned. How much use would his frail canvas covering be if the cougar didn't play according to the rules? He could taste blood in his mouth where he had bitten his lip to keep from crying out. Suppose the cougar did attack. How could he protect himself? Guns weren't allowed. Noiselessly, avoiding a squeaky board in his floor, he stole across the dark tent like a ghost. His fumbling fingers touched his Bible, passed on, and then returned to it. He stuffed it into his pajama top. It felt warm against his cold skin. He moved on. His right hand found the smooth wood handle of his double-bitted axe. Silently he hefted it and crept back and crouched on the cot. He stayed in one position for hours, his eyes staring into the blackness towards the swaying flap, his old fear threatening to wipe him out. The only prayer he could form was, "Protect me, Lord." Daylight came after what seemed like 100 years. The raucous caws of crows signalled that the long night was over. Jack stamped life back into his cramped, numb legs. Still clutching the axe, he untied the tent strings and looked out. Everything was as usual. The sky was blue. A slight breeze rustled the leaves. His borrowed transportation still sat unlocked nearby. Had he dreamed the whole thing? No, he still held the Bible in one hand. The axe was real and heavy in the other. So was the dull ache in his muscles from their tense vigil. He relaxed, glanced down, and his heart turned to stone. The axe slipped unheeded through his nerveless fingers. 3 feet from the opening to his tent, he saw cougar tracks, bigger than his hand, outlined clear and sharp in the undisturbed dust. Jack could feel nausea rise within him. He headed for a nearby clump of bushes. When he was through being sick, he staggered back to the tent, refusing to look at the tracks again. He reached for the radio connecting him with headquarters. He'd tell them he couldn't hack it. His hand fell halfway. What he was earning was vitally important. Mom and Dad and Mary were counting on him. Could he let them down just because he was scared? He searched for his Bible and discovered that it had fallen clear when he ran to the bushes. With a prayer for help, he riffled the pages, reading every scripture he could find on God's love and protection. Gradually his panic subsided. The cougar had come and gone. There was nothing fearsome in daylight. But what about tonight and all the other nights? Jack clamped down hard on the thought and started singing at the top of his lungs. Not popular songs, but church songs, ones that talked about God and his son. He forced himself to eat and get on with his duties. He kept going long after his work was through, hoping to exhaust himself so that he could sleep nights. It worked. By the time it was dark, he could hardly drag one foot after the other into his tent. He undressed and threw himself onto the bed. Instantly he was wide awake, listening for any sound that might not be normal. It was long after midnight before he fell asleep, and even then he was restless. He followed the same pattern for the next 2 days and nights. He was beginning to feel like a zombie. Chapter 8. The Lightning Storm. Late in the afternoon of the day that marked the end of his first week, Jack heard a familiar sound. He ran down the dusty road and met the pickup. "Dad, Mum, Mary!" He pretended to have dust in his eyes so they wouldn't see his tears of relief. "I didn't think you'd be back so soon." "I found a few days' work," Dad said, "and I got out of the woods so early today that we figured it was a good time for a visit." Dad's keen eyes met Jack squarely. "All right, son, let's have it. Why are you so worn out looking?" Jack tried to laugh, but the memory of sleepless nights swept over him and he could only stammer, I don't get much rest," he hurried on, hoping to cover up, "since the night the cougar came." "Cougar?" Mary stopped chasing a butterfly and turned her frightened eyes on him. "A cougar came here?" Jack licked his lips. "Yes, I heard cries in the night. The next morning I found tracks." His stomach turned over, but he added, "It hasn't been back." Mom's face turned whiter than the summer blouse she wore. "Oh, Jack, what did you do? Mary insisted on knowing. "Stayed on my bed, with the axe in one hand and my Bible in my pajama top." "You are so brave." 2 big tears crept into Mary's eyes. "Scared stiff is more like it," Jack admitted. Dad's steady look seemed to look straight through Jack. Then he said quietly, "You don't have to stay. Pack your gear and the Forest Service can find someone else." Jack could feel joy skyrocketing all through him. Dad wouldn't think he was a quitter. He could go home, maybe even to youth camp. He could have Mum's good cooking instead of cold spaghetti. He could sleep in his own bed instead of having nightmares on top of a deserted mountain. He impulsively took a step toward the hated tent and then stopped. He couldn't do it. He was in the Forest Service. He'd have to stick it out. God had opened a way for him to help his family. He couldn't desert them now. He paused just a moment, I'll stay, he said quietly. Jack hoped that his family would never know what it cost him to make that decision. Then he caught the tightening of Dad's strong jaw, the flash of his blue eyes. So Dad knew. Jack felt strangely comforted. Mary grunted.
Huh? You're braver than me.
Jack could feel the admiration in her voice. I'm bigger than you, Jack said. His smile felt like it was nearly back to normal. Come on, let me show you what I do. He hoped that talking about his job would keep back his insane desire to go back on his decision. He showed them a device with metal cups. This is my anemometer. It catches the wind and turns. You listen to the clicks and check with your watch against a chart. It tells you the force or speed of the wind. He picked up another piece of equipment. This is my rain gauge to check the amount of precipitation. And my sling psychrometer. Mary stared at the instrument and its two thermometers, one with a wet bulb, the other with a dry. The cooling that comes from evaporation makes a difference in the temperature, Jack explained. It's lower than the dry bulb. That difference tells how dry the atmosphere is. That's how the Forest Service knows when the woods have to be shut down to logging, Dad said. Even a spark from a chainsaw in dry air can start a raging fire. But how do we find a fire? Mary tugged at Jack's shirt. Over here. He led the way to a large stump. It held a cylinder marked off with 360 degrees. This is my fire finder. I orient it with my compass north and south. If I see smoke, I take a reading and call it in. The Forest Service headquarters get 3 readings from lookouts and plot them on a map. Where the lines cross is the correct fire location. Mary looked more impressed. Do you look through your binoculars a lot? Sure. We report in 3 times a day. Anything that seems out of the ordinary gets reported immediately. What about at night? Mary never ran out of questions. We're out of contact, except in dangerous situations such as lightning storms, when there would be someone on duty to take calls. Jack laughed. Remember last year when Dad's crew bus stopped in front of our house and the driver threw off Dad's lunch bucket and said Dad had gone to fight a fire? Mary's eyes were enormous, and we didn't see him for over a month until the fire was all put out. She giggled. I remember he didn't have a razor, and when he got home he was all scratchy. Was I ever? Dad rubbed his smooth-shaven chin. I've never felt so dirty in my whole life. But fighting fire is everyone's job. I remember standing on our big porch during that awful lightning storm and counting 23 fires on Silver Hill across from us, Mary said. We could see where the lightning struck and every time a new fire started. She hopped around on one foot. Remember how God sent a heavy rain right afterwards and all the fires went out, and we knew Dad could come home soon? Mom reminded. We can't stop lightning fires, but a lot more fires are caused by careless smokers and campers than by nature. Dad looked angry. Wildlife and trees suffer every year because of people. Is that why we don't smoke at our house? Mary asked. Smoking is a dangerous, dirty habit, Mom told her. God wants us to have healthy bodies. We should never put anything in them that might harm us. Again the hours flew too fast. Dad called Jack to one side. I don't know when we'll get back, son, he said as he looked into Jack's eyes. I do know you aren't a boy any longer. Only a real man faces his fears and doesn't run. God recognizes your struggles and will help you. Dad's approval warmed Jack clear to his bones. The next week went better. Then came the thing most feared by the Forest Service, a lightning storm. Jack saw it across the valley before it reached his lookout. He hurried to his radio. He had always looked forward to his radio contact at 7 each night. The lookout fire watchers were allowed to visit between 7 and 8, and they always had interesting things to tell. Pete usually monopolized the time with his bigger-than-life stories, but it was still fun. Now Jack tuned in and breathlessly told the others. There's a bad storm coming. I can already see static electricity forming into balls of light. They're rolling along the mountainside. Pete, they are getting closer to you all the time. See the weird light?
Section 3.
Man, I'm getting out of this place, but fast. The air waves crackled with the curse, Pete added. Don't do that, Pete, Bill's voice cut in. You'll never get down the trail before it hits. You'll be a sitting duck if you try. In about 5 minutes there's going to be a blue light all over and around your lookout. It's going to glow blue on your walls. And you think I'm going to stay in here? I'm not a complete fool. Pete sounded petrified as well as furious. Sit in the glass chair, Bill ordered. It's insulated. Nothing can hurt you if you stay put. Are you sure? Pete's question faded. He's right, Jack shouted. Get in that chair and stay there. A warning rumble of thunder sounded ominously, too close for comfort. Bill interrupted. Do as you're told, Pete. Ed, Tom, you okay? Yeah, the other two lookouts chorused. Okay, everyone to his lightning station. Signing off. Bill's voice stopped suddenly. Jack quickly ducked from his tent and headed for the jalopy. He didn't have an insulated glass chair. The car was the best place for him. The storm was beautiful, though frightening. Great balls of light rolled along the ridges and hillsides like bodiless ghosts. The wind shrieked as if a thousand devils had been loosed in the heavy air. Jack found himself torn between wild fascination with the storm and fear. The jalopy swayed now and then when a gust of wind caught it. What must it be like on the high peaks, he wondered. Pete would get the worst of it. Jack grinned in the gloom. Mount Chinook suddenly seemed very safe and secure compared with the other lookouts. There were more lightning explosions and thunderbolts than the 4th of July. At last the storm moved on, leaving silence, but only for moments. Suddenly the heavens opened in a downpour that made Jack think of Noah's flood. After its initial burst, the rain fell steadily for an hour, then dwindled to a drizzle. Jack was cold by the time he got to his tent. He crawled deep into his sleeping bag, glad for its warmth. He was glad also for the rain. The loggers could work regular hours, at least for a time. Maybe Dad's temporary job would turn into a permanent one. I wonder what the family's doing, he said aloud. Probably sitting on the big covered porch watching the storm. Maybe even talking about me. He wiggled his cold toes. When I get home, I'm going to sleep for a solid week in a warm bed. He stopped talking to himself, but his thoughts went on. In the short time he'd been here, he had been scared by a cougar, lived through a lightning storm, and suffered homesickness like he wouldn't have thought real. He lived on cold food, bathed in ice water, and stuck out all the inconveniences. I wonder, Jack burrowed even further into his bag, I wonder what new and wonderful thing I'll get to do next. He shuddered, half asleep. Don't tell me, God. I don't think I want to know ahead of time. Just let it be a surprise. Chapter 9. To Snowdon and Back. Oh, boy. Jack stepped from his tent. The bushes and stunted trees were still dripping, but the sun had come out. The whole world looked as if it had just been washed. Even the dusty ground was fresh, settled by the storm. Lazy white clouds smiled at Jack as if to say, "We're through for now." Jack did all his morning duties, whistling loudly. He even cut a bouquet of fireweed to stick in a tin can on his table. He would just bet the loggers were rejoicing over the rain, too. Besides, it meant that he could leave the lookout and go to town for the afternoon. He let out a yell. It was actually a good thing that he had to drive to town. Somehow he'd broken the horsehair in his firefinder, and he would have to get another. He felt foolish about that. Breaking it had been a dumb mistake. It had seemed a long way up when Jack moved into his summer home. It seemed even longer down. The road was filled with even more chuck holes from the rain. Dripping branches grew close on both sides of the road, slapping at the jalopy as he went by. "When I get down at the end of the summer, I'll give her a super car wash before giving her back to Bill," he decided. A wave of gratitude shot over him. Bill was a real friend. Every turn of the wheel said, "Home." Jack passed the Forest Service compound, staring intently at the horse corral. He slowed and then went on. Getting a horsehair for his firefinder in bright sunlight would be embarrassing. He would wait until dusk, just before returning to Mount Chinook. "Guess who's home, Mum?" he shouted the minute he braked in front of their place. The door popped open and Mary flew out. "Jack!" She hugged him hard. "What are you doing here? You didn't get fired, did you?" "Of course not. I came down because it rained so hard, but just for a few hours." Mom came out on the porch waving a spatula. "Warm cookies, Jack." Jack sniffed. "So that's why I followed my nose." It was so good to be home. Jack straddled a chair, stuffed himself with spicy cookies, and finished off with a huge glass of milk. "How many may I take back with me?" he asked. Mom pushed her curly hair back and laughed. "Most of them. I can always bake more." "Was the lightning storm scary up there?" Mary had planted herself next to him and was gobbling cookies as fast as Jack. "Was it ever?" He told them how balls of static electricity ran along the ridges and hills. "It was beautiful, though." Evening came too soon. It was so hard leaving that he wondered if it might have been better not to come home. At least he had had a warm bath. He'd soaked in it until he nearly fell asleep. Reluctantly, Jack headed back towards town. He parked the jalopy next to the horse corral and quietly went out. Luck was with him. The place was deserted except for pack mules and horses. Great. All he had to do was find some horsehair on the ground. He peered down but found nothing. He walked a little, still intently watching the uneven ground. It was no use. Unbelievable though it seemed, Jack could not find one single horsehair. What was he supposed to do now? He couldn't see himself knocking the off-duty ranger's door and saying, "Please, I need a horsehair." He grinned in spite of himself at the ridiculous picture that would make. One of the horses whinnied, shifted, and twitched her black tail. Jack stared. Of course, there was his answer, hanging behind every horse in the corral. All the horsehair he'd need for a dozen instruments. He'd get the hair right from a horse's tail. He crept forward, almost holding his breath. The nearest horse backed away. He tried again. The next horse snorted and galloped across the corral with the others in hot pursuit. Just what he needed. A bunch of restless horses kicking up their heels and making a commotion that would bring someone out to check what was happening. Jack sighed. It didn't matter how long it took, he had to get that horsehair. Half an hour later he admitted defeat. There was no way that skittish bunch of nags was going to stand still long enough for him to pluck even one hair from their tails. "I should be a mystery writer," he muttered crossly. "I could write a story and call it Tale of the Missing Hair, instead of T-A-L-E of the Missing H-E-I-R. But standing there mumbling wasn't going to solve his problem. He racked his brain trying to think of another way. It was almost dark. The jalopy's lights weren't the greatest. He needed to get over those switchbacks before pitch dark set in. He tried everything he knew, except one thing. He crouched in a corner of the corral, feeling miserable and foolish. "It doesn't seem very respectful to ask you for a horsehair, Lord, but I don't know what else to do. Dad would always say the hairs on your head are numbered, but my hair won't work. Could you help? I have to have it." He opened his eyes and looked at the huddled horses on the far side of the corral. Grimacing, he tried to approach them again, hoping they might have accepted his presence enough to let him get near. They sidled away at his second step. There was nothing left to do but go to the ranger. He couldn't hang around the corral any longer. God must have been too busy or didn't think a prayer like his was worth answering. Automatically he glanced at the ground, still trying to find a loose hair, but the rain had washed away any that had been there. Jack headed for the jalopy. Only pale gleams of light were left in the sky. Walking by a fence, his hand brushed against something. He turned and saw that something was caught in a strand of wire. He touched it again and nearly shouted. The limp, small strand was dirty, but it was a horsehair. Why hadn't he thought to check the fence first? Horses like to reach over fences, and the hair from their manes got caught in the wire. A second thought hit him as he backed the jalopy and turned onto the road, triumphantly clutching his precious find. Why hadn't he asked God first instead of going through the comedy routine of trying to snatch hair from a live horse's tail? The strand he found had been there all along. He'd just been too busy doing things his own way to notice. Depression settled on Jack's mind like a heavy blanket as he left the edge of Snowdon and started down the secondary road. Now that he didn't have to worry about the horsehair, Mount Chinook and his loneliness loomed large in his mind. It was about the middle of July. Fire season could last clear to Labor Day if the hot weather held. 6 more weeks. Could he endure them? He swung away from the secondary road and onto the dirty dirt road leading to the temporary lookout. Automatically shifting down as the jalopy started climbing, he drove carefully, feeling gloomy but watching the road. 2 switchbacks from the top, he rounded the hairpin curve and braked sharply. A little family of deer was crossing the road. There was a buck with its head lifted proudly, a doe, smaller but graceful, and 2 spotted fawns. All were obviously dazzled by his headlights. Jack waited. Then, when they showed no signs of fear, he rolled down the jalopy window and whistled. The buck's ears pricked, and with a giant bound he leaped into the bush at the side of the road. The doe followed, and the fawns scrambled after her. Jack drove on, but his throat was tight. For as long as he could remember, his family had been going on outings to the woods and the river below their place. Picnics in the summer, sledding on the hill in the winter, wildflower hunting in spring. Each year they watched the swollen river after the warm wind called Chinook melted the snow off the mountains and sent torrents of muddy water racing down the riverbed and spilling over the banks. Dad always led the family on these outings. Sometimes it got dark before they reached home. When Jack and Mary were small, Dad carried them. As they grew, they trotted securely behind him, just as the spotted fawns had done. Reaching his tent, Jack jumped out of the jalopy and slammed the door. "You'd better see a shrink if watching deer affects you like this. You're a man, not a 3-year-old. Now act like one." Yet all the preaching to himself didn't fill the empty, hurting space inside that grew every day. The fears of danger, both real and imaginary, were slowly replaced by that gnawing sense of total aloneness. Jack didn't know what was worse, the isolation or the fear he had never conquered. For 3 weeks his only contact with other humans came at reporting time and at the anticipated 7 to 8 visit with the other fire watchers. They were feeling the apartness too. He could feel it in their conversation. He didn't tell them he had gone to Snowdon. If he were on Indian Peak or Avalanche or Fir or Big Bear, the last thing he'd want to hear was that another lookout had gone home, even for such a short visit. Dad and Mom finally came with the mail and fresh supplies. Jack had thought saying goodbye would get easier each time. It hadn't. Every time was worse. He was almost glad they didn't make it too often. The next few days were always unbearable instead of just hard. There were a few bright spots, though. The cougar didn't come back. There weren't any more lightning storms. Work was routine, and Jack had free time. He spent it in various ways, picking the red and blue huckleberries that grew abundantly over the Logdorf areas, watching birds, reading his Bible. He thought a lot about Mary's comment on her first visit,
You are sure close to God up here. She was right. With only distant sounds of logging to break the silence, Jack agreed with Mary. Every tree and flower bowed before him when the breeze caught them. Funny, Jack muttered. He had formed the habit of talking to himself. I always knew about God. I've always known the Lord, at least as Saviour and friend. Now I see him as Creator. A lone eagle soared above, its giant wingspan casting a shadow over the hillside. Even though I knew God made all this, I never thought how much he must have enjoyed making it. A few days later, Jack had unexpected visitors. A once shiny, now dusty car came slowly around the bend. "Thank God," the driver called. He and his wife, an older couple, climbed out. The man's face was worried. "We must have taken the wrong fork in the road. Are we glad to get where we can turn around and that we found someone?" "We thought we would run out of road and have to back down," the woman said. There were traces of dried tears on her face. From the way they were dressed, Jack guessed they were city people out for a long mountain drive. "We thought we could get blackberries," the man explained. Jack laughed and waved to the sloping hillside. "Help yourself." Some of the worry left the man's face, but he looked anxiously at his wife. "Do you want to rest while I get the berries?" He glanced at the car. "You are welcome to lie down in the tent," Jack said. "It's not fancy, but it's clean." The woman's smile reminded him of Mom. She disappeared inside the tent. Jack helped pick berries while the lady rested. When they finished, the strangers insisted on sharing their lunch. They were both interested in his job and watched curiously as he went about his duties. "That awful road at least led somewhere," they told him when it was time for them to go. "We're going to stop at the ranger station in Snowdon and tell them what a fine, helpful young man they have up here." "Thanks." Jack waved them out of sight, warmed by the praise, but already aware of the fresh loneliness attacking him as their motor sounds died away. Chapter 10. You have to stop working. As if to make up for the time lost during the rainstorm, during the next few weeks the sun attacked the earth with the hottest rays of summer. During the day Jack sweated over every duty. Only the nighttime coolness on the mountaintop brought relief and the need to use a blanket. And then it came, the time he had dreaded most of all. "My psychrometer reading shows extreme dryness," he told the district ranger one morning. "I suppose that means..." "Yes," the ranger sighed. "Get down and tell the loggers they're through until the weather breaks." "With conditions like this, the work is too dangerous. The foreman's name is Red Willoughby. Talk to him." Jack stepped out and gazed across the stump-dotted hillside, his mouth drier than the air. Suddenly he hated the golden sun that gulped moisture from everything, the complaining crows, even the fireweed. Those rough loggers were working hard to feed their families. How would they feel when he went down there and told them they had to shut down and get out of the woods? To make matters worse, it wasn't a Snowdon crew. Jack knew all the loggers in Snowdon. This was an outfit from a nearby town that had bid lower than local companies and gotten the contract. Jack had only seen them at a distance, but they were big. His feelings of being a man fell away. "What made me think I wanted this job anyway?" He kicked a rock hard and was savagely glad when it spun down the hillside. "If I were a logger and some kid came in and told me to go home, I couldn't even imagine what he would do. One thing, he wouldn't have warm feelings for that kid. On the other hand, letting the loggers work under such conditions would be dangerous to them and everyone else," Jack said, trying to get enough courage to head across the logged-off area. "But God, those men need work so much." Like an instant replay, he was again talking with the mill owner, seeing the hurt on his face when he said, "I've got two openings.
15 men begging for jobs, heads of families, several kids, need money to put food on the table. I can't do a thing. Jack's throat got tight. He had felt sorry for the mill owner then, but he hadn't really understood how terrible the man felt, knowing there was no choice. Now he knew. Well, putting it off wouldn't make it any easier. Jack picked up his psychometer and headed down the hill toward the loggers. He dawdled as much as he could getting to the logging operations. He even practiced approaching the crew. But when he got there, everything he'd thought about vanished. When Jack got to the first crew, he asked, "Where's Mr. Willoughby?" "Mister?" The bearded giant threw back his head and roared, "Hey, Red, there's a kid here to see you." The head logger jerked off his hard hat and wiped his sweaty face. "Can it, Barrett?" the burly man growled. He gripped Jack's hand in a bone-crushing shake. "You're the lookout kid, aren't you?" The word kid put Jack back in diaper days, but he had a job to do. Stalling wouldn't help. "I'm Jack Montgomery." "John's kid?" "You know Dad?" Jack couldn't believe it. "Sure," the big man grinned. "Who doesn't?" His grin faded and was replaced by a scowl. "You didn't come down here to shoot the breeze. What do you want?" Jack swallowed hard. "Mr. Willoughby, I..." A burst of laughter deepened the head logger's scowl. "Red." "Red?" Jack hated himself for floundering. He stood straight and said, "The fire danger's extreme. I have orders to tell you that your outfit's shut down until the weather breaks." The man called Barrett shoved his way through the circle of unfriendly men. Even those who had nodded and smiled when Red spoke about Dad now glared at him. Barrett bellowed, "No kids telling me I can't work. I've got to pay my bills." "Me too, and me." The low grumbles rose to a menacing roar. "I'll handle it." Red's voice cut through the mutinous storm the way lightning slices a grey sky. The muttering dwindled. Jack was scared but held his ground even when Red said suspiciously, "If the pressure's all that bad, how come our instrument doesn't show it? We keep a close eye on that baby and it registers that there's enough moisture in the air for us to keep working." Jack hesitated. "Sure you know how to read instruments, sonny?" Barrett's jeering laugh brought a round of murmured agreement. Jack looked Red in the eye. "Can I see your instrument?" It was the only thing he could think to say. "Yeah." Red strode off and returned a few minutes later. He pushed the instrument into Jack's hand. "See? Shows right there that we're okay." He didn't sound smug, just impatient and anxious to get through with Jack and back to work. Jack looked at the instrument and gasped with relief. "No wonder it isn't working right. It's caked over with dirt." He showed Red his own spotless psychrometer. "Thank you. Full clear to the curled up toes in his heavy boots that he had brought it along. See the difference?" Red stared, and then his face sagged. The deep lines told more clearly than words how much the work was needed. When he finally answered, his voice was lifeless. "Shut her down, men. Pass the word to the others." Barrett raised his lips in a sneer. "So the kid wins." Red came to life. His eyes blazed. "I told you to can it, Barrett. The kid's just doing his job. He's a logger's kid. He probably doesn't like what he has to do any better than we do." He looked at Jack, then at his men again. "Coming down here to shut down a bunch of roughnecks like us ain't the world's easiest job either. Lay off him." Jack was touched by the foreman's support. "I really am sorry," he told Red when the others moved off, shoulders drooping, to collect their tools and lunch buckets. "We haven't had it any better at our house this last year. That's why I'm up here at the lookout." He held his breath. Why had he spilled out all that to a stranger, even if Red did know Dad? A somber look filled Red's eyes. "Logging is a bad business now, kid. When guys like your dad and me were growing up, it was a lot different. You aren't going into it, are you? No, Dad says I'm going to college. After I finish, if I choose to go logging, he won't say a word, but he wants me to get an education first. Listen to your old man, kid. Red's heavy hand came down so hard Jack staggered. Red's wry grin didn't hide how dead serious he was. Wish I'd had a guy like John Montgomery for a dad. Mine died when I was a kid. His smile changed to another frown. Your dad casts a mighty big shadow. If you can live up to it, you'll be all right. Red shook hands with another grasp that left Jack's summer-hardened hands tingling, but the tingle in his heart as he climbed back to his lonely perch was stronger. He had known Dad was respected in Snowden, but word must really get around, for even outside outfits knew him. A picture of Dad's steady blue eyes and his fun-loving but quiet attitude made Jack remember how one of the men Dad worked with gave him the nickname Gentleman Logger. It fit. Dad was one of the last of the old-time gentlemen who held doors and stood when women came into the room. Red Willoughby was right. Dad did cast a long, strong shadow. Jack sighed. He couldn't be Dad, but he could be the best Jack there was. The fears, dangers, and responsibilities he had faced this summer, the scripture reading, living where he was forced to think and act for himself, had brought a lot of changes in his thinking. He had learned to appreciate how much home was worth. He'd thought a lot about what made it special, and decided that it was because Dad and Mom really lived the golden rule. Never once had he heard either of them insist on doing something he wanted to do. It was always, "Would you like to?" followed by, "Of course, if you do." They found real happiness in serving God and looking after each other's happiness. Jack reached the top of his mountain and threw himself in the shade to rest beneath a tree. But his thoughts kept churning. When he got married, he wanted that kind of marriage. None of this on-again, off-again stuff for him. He knew how some of his friends felt when parents had split. "Whoever marries me is going to know she's stuck with me," he grinned. Hands clasped behind his head, flat on his back, Jack watched a lone cloud sail by in the deep blue overhead. Andrea Thomas's laughing dark eyes flashed into his mind, and he grunted and rolled over. "Time to get back to work and forget something that is a long way in the future," he told himself. 6 to 7 o'clock was the best part of Jack's whole day. Except for the one stormy day, he got out his big white sheet every night and waved it furiously. Far below the gallant banner of what Dad had called the Montgomery's Goodnight Rendezvous streamed in the air on the end of a long pole. Each night Jack remembered that Mom had said the waving sheet meant all was well, his family loved him, God bless and good night. It was amazing how that contact cheered up even the loneliest days. With the loggers gone, the mountainside was even quieter, and Jack looked forward even more to his evening wave. He had a calendar and marked off the days, using Labor Day as an ending goal. Each day that passed, he marked a large X with a felt-tipped pen. August followed July, sweltering in the valley that cried for rain and got none. A few times clouds gathered. Once they even dropped a bit of their contents and then hurried on before spilling any more. The few drops didn't cool the air enough to permit work. One night during the first week of August, Jack waved his signal and then focused his binoculars to catch the answer. Nothing moved in the valley. Funny, maybe it isn't quite six. Jack checked his watch. The hands cut it in perfect vertical halves. He snatched his sheet and waved again. Still there was no response. Jack felt a tiny pulse beat in his throat. Where were they? Why didn't someone wave? The tick from his watch sounded like a grandfather clock. He tried to ignore it. He kept his binoculars steady on the little spot that meant home. 5 after 6, 10 after, 1/4 after. Where was his family? They had never failed him before, not even the night he was calling in to a report of smoke near Big Bear Mountain and couldn't wave until 6:30.
Section 4.
Bands of fear were tightening on Jack's chest until he could barely breathe. Something was wrong. His family wouldn't let him down when they knew he was counting on them. Was one of them sick? That wouldn't keep the others from waving. 25 to 7. 22. 1:45. Jack's imagination ran wild. Had there been an accident? Were they all at the hospital? He strained his eyes, praying for that white signal. The evening shadows were already heavy in the valley. Soon the flag would be invisible, no matter how wildly it was waved. He let the binoculars fall to his chest and dangle from the strap. 10 to 7, 5 to. What was happening down in the valley? Determination filled Jack's heart. He'd take Bill's jalopy and go home. He took a step towards it and then stopped. It was the worst moment in his life. God, what shall I do? His piercing cry rang across the shaded ridge and echoed back. His family must need him. Yet the fire danger was extreme. What might be the consequences if he left his post and something unforeseen came up? Duty tore at him. He couldn't leave. He had a job to do. He glanced at his watch. 3 minutes to 7. It would be dark in 5 more minutes. He held up the binoculars again, hoping, praying, passionately, waiting for the signal that must come, but didn't. 2 minutes to 7. 1 minute to 7. 7 o'clock. Slowly Jack started to lower the binoculars, his heart heavy, his brain racing with the horrible possibilities, the imaginary reasons why someone hadn't waved. Wait, was that movement? He squinted hard, trying to see through the gloom. Something white, it seemed no larger than a big moth, waved in the valley below. Thank God! Jack snatched his own signal sheet and waved it high. There was a little more light on the ridge than in the valley. Dad's powerful binoculars would pick it up. Warmth stole through him. He didn't know why they were late, but all was well. He wouldn't have to toss and turn in the night wondering. Then, too, maybe the folks would come up soon. Chapter 11. Trouble on Avalanche Peak. Every day for a week, Jack listened for the sound of the pickup. When it finally came, he was at the door before even Mary could clamber out. But she beat his question with the answer. We took the car to be worked on, and they took so long we were late. Her blue eyes shone bright in her flushed face. Did you worry? Mom said you would. Sure. Jack's visions of someone being hurt seemed dim in the bright sunlight, but they were still real enough to darken his thoughts. We did too. Dad drove home as fast as he could. It got darker and darker. We didn't know if you would still be watching. Mary heaved a sigh of relief. Boy, were we glad when you were. Me too. Jack didn't add anything else. He could see by his parents' faces that he didn't have to. The worst thing now is the loneliness, he told Dad and Mom after Mary had moved off to pick berries. When I get down, I'll probably talk for a solid month. We're very proud of you, son, Dad smiled his slow smile. Mom was busily laying a cloth for a picnic lunch. How are the other lookouts getting along? I saw Bill's mother the other day, and she mentioned that he was going to be one glad boy when summer was over. She weighted the napkins down with salt and pepper shakers. Evidently the Forest Service packed in more supplies to him, and he sent a note back to her. He never says anything on the radio, Jack grinned sheepishly. We don't want Pete to think we're a bunch of crybabies. A frown replaced his grin. Actually, I'm really worried about Pete. Hey, Jack, look at all my berries. Mary was back, her hands stained with berry juice, but she was triumphant. Jack shook his head at the folks. He would confide in them later. It was so great to be gathering around the picnic lunch. Dad asked the Lord's blessing, and they all dug in. Jack didn't get a chance to confide his worries about Pete. He forgot about it until after the family was gone. Then he got busy with his duties and had no time to think about Pete. The 6 o'clock wave showed that his family had made it home okay. He had nothing to do except wait for the 7 o'clock fun hour of talking with the other lookouts. Jack threw himself on his cot, remembering some of the things the others had shared. Bill had seen a mother bear and 2 cubs when they climbed down for water from Indian Peak. Ed had laughed and said he was the one who should have seen the bear. After all, he was on Big Bear Mountain. Tom complained that there wasn't a fir tree within a mile of his fir mountain lookout. And he had been the funniest. He confessed that when he was assigned to Fir Mountain, he decided it was a good time to lose weight. So along with his supplies, he packed in about a ton of instant diet powder to make a high-protein, low-calorie drink. Yet the longer he stayed, the tighter his jeans got. He couldn't figure it out. He was drinking the glass of liquid with every meal. Bill could almost have made the other lookouts hear without using a radio when he yelled, "With every meal? Tom, you're supposed to be drinking that stuff instead of meals." The lookouts roared and never let Tom forget it, but he was a good-natured chap and proudly announced a few days later that he had thrown the diet powder away, begun eating right, and with a good bit of exercise was beginning to slim down. There was real camaraderie among them, bound in loneliness as they were. Much as Jack missed home, he could appreciate that he at least had occasional visitors. Not that he was at any country club, but he was ahead of the others. He could feel a change in his friends. They were still full of fun, but seemed quieter and more thoughtful. A person couldn't spend that much time alone with nature and stay the same. Pete had changed the most of all. At first he'd bragged that everything he did was bigger and better and more dangerous than what anyone else did. Then he grew quieter, more willing to listen to the others. Lately he had seemed anxious to be a part of the group without taking over the 7 o'clock talk. A deep crease etched itself into Jack's forehead. He was frankly worried about Pete. Was it possible the swaggering Pete was close to cracking up? "Don't be stupid," he told himself. It didn't help. Pete definitely had some kind of problem. It had started several days after the scary lightning storm when they all tuned in for evening chats. "You guys won't believe what happened last night," Pete had said. "Probably not," Jack thought to himself. Pete told so many wild stories. "I woke up and there was bright moonlight in the room." Jack closed his eyes, visualizing the Avalanche Peak room snug and secure. Bill was probably doing the same and gloating over not being there. Jack was ashamed of his own gladness, but shocked back to full attention when Pete's strangely hoarse voice went on, "There was a huge fuzzy animal standing over me." "What? You're kidding." "But there's no way," Jack said. Then he broke off. Telling Pete that it was impossible for a wild animal to get into that particular lookout would be like calling him a liar. "Must have been a nightmare," Bill commented. "Nope, it was an animal. Big. I was so scared I just lay there, and pretty soon it left." The conversation changed, but Jack wondered. He knew the rock pile that housed the Avalanche Peak lookout all too well. Besides, even if something had gotten up there, which it couldn't, how could an animal get in through the sturdy door? No tent flap there, but a solid wooden door. And Jack just bet Pete didn't leave it open at night. Jack wished he could talk it over with Bill, but he couldn't with Pete and Ed and Tom all on the line too. He was glad when Pete reported nothing strange for quite a while. It probably had been a nightmare. Now Jack almost wished the 7 o'clock hour was over. Last night Pete had described in detail how somehow a fire got started at the base of the cliff and how he had put it out before it could spread and do any more damage. Again Jack knew it was totally impossible. There were absolutely no trees or vegetation of any kind in that area, or even close to it. Bill sounded strained when he asked casually, "Just where did you say it was?" "Right at the base of the cliff." Pete was impatient. "Oh." Bill didn't say anything else, but Jack could picture him scratching his head and thinking. The 7 o'clock chats had barely begun that evening when Pete interrupted a story Ed was telling by saying, "Another fire today, in almost the same place as yesterday's. It's a good thing I got up earlier than usual. I was able to contain it again." If he noticed the lack of response, he didn't let on. He just rambled on about how he was doing his job while the others had it easy. Jack had never been more depressed. It sounded like Pete was going crazy, telling the same story two nights in a row. "Did you report into headquarters?" Jack managed to get in between Pete's sentences. "Naturally. What do you think I am, nuts?" Pete sounded disgusted. "This is a fire-watching job, remember? Of course I reported it." Jack breathed a sigh of relief. If Forest Service personnel were aware of what Pete was saying, he didn't have to decide whether it was his own responsibility to report anything, but he dreaded the next night's chat. All through his work the next day, he had a feeling that things weren't right on Avalanche Peak. He even offered a prayer for Pete. All the others were already visiting when Pete tuned in. He sounded as though he had been running. Short breaths, almost gasps, came over the radio. "Sorry, I'm late. Another fire. This time it got almost to the timber before I was able to put it out." All Jack's concern rushed back. He had hoped Pete might be better. Instead, he was almost incoherent. Didn't the district ranger know how bad Pete was getting? Bragging had been irritating, but this was a whole lot worse. Pete actually seemed to believe what he was telling. Jack was glad when 8 o'clock came and he could shut down the radio. But he lay wide awake in the darkness for hours. Even the clear day following and the great white clouds gathering with the promise of possible rain didn't lift Jack's mood. Something was going to happen, and all he could do was to ask God to look after Pete. With reluctant fingers, Jack adjusted the radio that evening. Bill, then Ed, then Tom came on, but not Pete. Even when they called, "Come in, Pete," there was no answer. Now they shared their worries, intermittently trying to raise Pete on the radio. It was no use. When their chat time was over, Jack sat staring out the open tent flap. Where was Pete? No matter how busy the lookouts were, not one had ever failed to report to the 7 o'clock radio calls. Too restless to sleep, Jack walked a little way across the ridge, staring towards Avalanche Peak, silhouetted against the bright cold stars. A feeling of insignificance and helplessness swept over him. Yet he had the Lord as a friend. He hadn't realized how often he had turned to God this summer until now. Pete had no one. The thought jarred Jack. How would he have survived without faith, even on Mount Chinook? The other lookouts laughed a lot, but Jack knew it was put on. He breathed deeply. Somewhere under these same brilliant stars, Pete was fighting a battle. He could be hurt, he could be trapped, waiting for someone to come. But who would know where to look? Jack paced the top of Mount Chinook for several hours. Even the fear of the dark that he hadn't totally overcome didn't stop his walking or his churning feelings. If only Pete knew Jesus. It was the only thing in the world that made the difference between being terrified and quitting, and being scared and going on. "If I haven't learned anything else this summer, I've learned that," Jack told the night wind. The clouds that earlier had been gathering lazily now boiled up and blotted out the stars. A drop of rain spattered Jack's face and he headed for the tent. The last thing Jack remembered before falling asleep was that he had known Jesus and Pete hadn't, and now it was too late to tell him. Chapter 12. Goodbye, Chinook. Would the day never end? Jack did every task mechanically. He tried to study, he hiked miles and found the time passed more slowly than the black ant that was painstakingly carrying a crumb of bread off somewhere. He wanted to ask about Pete when he made his daily reports, but he didn't know if he should. Surely there would be an answer at the 7 o'clock call. There was an answer. When Jack and the others tuned in, a strange voice said, "Hi, I'm Kenneth, the new lookout on Avalanche Peak." Jack felt his hands get sweaty. He asked, "What happened to Pete? Is he okay?" Kenneth sounded reassuring. "He's going to be all right. He got out in time." "But where is he?" Jack was almost shouting. "He's in the hospital. Evidently the loneliness really got to him. He's used to city lights. Anyway, when he saw that another storm might be coming yesterday, he grabbed his personal stuff and split. He hiked down to the logging road and caught a ride with some tourists. He's lucky they were there. None of the logging outfits are working, and he could have had one long walk back into town. He stumbled into headquarters, mumbling about fires and fuzzy animals. I guess the tourists were really glad to get rid of him. Pete had slipped running down the trail and turned his ankle. It was swollen when he got in. The district ranger sent him straight to the hospital. The doctor said a few more days on the lookout and Pete might have been in the middle of a nervous breakdown. Jack's heart pounded, thinking of how Pete must have looked when he got to Snowdon. I felt sorry for the guy. Kenneth's voice dropped until Jack could barely hear him. At suppression school he was a pain in the neck, but now... He broke off. There was a long silence before Bill said, "I can understand it. There have been times up here when I was tempted to just walk out. I got over them by thinking of all the stuff I was going to do to my jalopy with the money I'm earning." "I've read every book I brought at least 6 times, Tom chimed in, and Ed added, "Me too. I've even tried writing a journal." "Why'd Pete always have to be showing how brave he was?" Bill wanted to know. "I guess that's what it takes to survive where he lives," Kenneth said. "I learned a little more about his background, and I'll just say we're pretty lucky compared with Pete. If we'd been knocked around the way he was, who knows what we'd be like." Jack finally found his voice. "I've sure learned to appreciate my home more this summer." "Same here," came the chorus of agreement, and Bill added, "I have to admit I'm counting the hours till this job's over." After the others signed off, Jack sat at his radio thinking about Pete. He remembered how their pastor preached one week about trying to make it without God. He could almost quote one part. "Some think they don't need God and his son. They think they can get along fine. Sometimes they do, at least for a while, but the time will come when they fall, and there won't be anyone there to pick them up." Pete was a good example. Jack could almost see his face in the darkness, rude and arrogant. If he'd ever heard of God or Jesus, it was probably only as swear words. Yet there had been something inside him crying out to be recognized. Jack remembered the surprised way he had looked when Jack congratulated him on finding the fire at suppression school, and how he'd gotten friendlier with the other guys during evening chats. Jack could visualize Pete scrambling down his rocky mountain after seeing a storm on its way, and remembering that other storm, sitting in an insulated chair, watching blue light harmlessly run off the lookout, but caught in the middle of the eerie glow. Pete had come in talking about big fuzzy animals. Had he felt pursued all the way down the trail, past Nameless Lake? How far had he dragged his rapidly swelling ankle? What other misery, real or imagined, had he gone through? He must have known that there was no logging truck to give him a ride. Had he forced himself to walk in the direction of Snowdon, wondering if he would have to walk all those miles down a dusty road? Soberly, Jack prepared for the night. In all probability, he would never see Pete again. By the time he finished his own job, Pete would be far away in his own city. Yet Jack knew that there would always be a nagging regret that he hadn't shared his faith, which could have made things different for Pete. At least he could have tried. Waves of rain beat over the land over the next few days. Jack rejoiced. The loggers and their families would be ecstatic. It also meant that his stay on the lookout was getting closer to its end. When the weather cleared, Jack was told, "New job for you. We'll be sending up a crew and you can help them with the slash burning." It was hard work, but Jack enjoyed it. First, wide fire breaks had to be made entirely around the area to be burned over. Downed limbs, trees, everything that might burn was cleared away until there was a shallow, ditch-like clearing surrounding the logged-off hillside. Inside lay all the debris from the logging operations. Rotted wood, timber too small to be harvested, snags and branches. Next came the fun part, even if it could be dangerous. "Remember not to get below someone working above you," the crew boss warned. "We don't want anyone caught in a circle of fire." Jack took the kerosene drip torch and started off at a fast walk. Fiery drops dribbled down the wick, setting fires behind him. The slash smouldered, then burst into flames. back and forth, back and forth. The wind was right, a slight movement, but not enough to carry danger. Hundreds of tiny individual fires burned all across the hillside when Jack and the others had finished. They gathered by the firebreak, watching the flames. "Pretty, isn't it?" Jack wiped a sooty hand across his forehead, adding a black streak to his sweaty face. An older worker stood nearby. "It's beautiful when you're setting it, not when you're fighting it." His dirty face was grim. "Hey, watch it over there," he pointed. "The fire's trying to cross the break." Jack and the others raced to the place and beat at the flames with shovels. The fire retreated from the fire break as if discouraged. By the end of the week, nothing remained of the clearing but charred wood. Jack stood with the crew boss. "It's hard to believe that some day loggers will be here again cutting timber," Jack said, staring hard at the burned-over hillside. His boss smiled. "That's what the Forest Service Conservation Program is all about. Logging, clean-up, burning, lying fallow over the winter, replanting trees, waiting, logging. The process makes sure that there will always be lumber for your kids and theirs. The earth renews herself if we just let her." For just a moment, the boss's work-worn hand rested on Jack's shoulder. "You're a good man, Montgomery, just like your dad." Jack blinked hard in the bright sunlight. He couldn't have been given a better compliment. 2 days later, he got the call he had been expecting. "Get ready to move out. You're through with Mount Chinook tomorrow." Now everything was last. The last binocular watching for smoke, the last psychrometer and rain gauge reading, the last evening chats. There was no serious talk this time. Each of the lookouts was glad it was over. Yet Bill put the general feeling into words when he said, "It's been hard, but I'm glad for the experience." He hesitated, then laughed. "Probably not glad enough to do it again, though." "If we don't see you in town, good luck," Ed put in. "Yeah, maybe we'll get together again at suppression school next year, or even fighting fire." Jack was silent. He hadn't realized how hard saying goodbye would be. When the last lookout had signed off, the night was unusually still. Even the multitude of sounds that had been so menacing at the beginning of summer were hushed. Nightbirds cried. But in the distance, Jack remembered what Tom had said after Kenneth went off the air. "I just wish Pete could have held out a little longer. Now that I stuck it, even when I hated it, I'm like Bill, pretty proud of myself. Pete would have been, too." The next day, Jack broke camp. It was strange knowing that next year his little tent frame home wouldn't huddle on Mount Chinook. There would be a regular lookout. It was almost dusk when he finished his work. Driving home, he grinned at the horse corrals, remembering the ridiculous picture he must have made chasing after horsehair. Bill's jalopy obediently speeded up when Jack got close to home. "Old girl, I'll wash you and give you a good polish tomorrow," he promised. Just having the jalopy up there had been a big help, knowing that in an emergency he had a way down. The next day, Jack felt strangely restless. School didn't start until the following week. A lot of kids were out of town for vacations. He cleaned the jalopy, waxed it until it shone, and slowly drove over to Bill's house. It was great seeing his friend after all those weeks. "You've lived through it, I see." Bill's deep tan looked good against his dark hair and eyes. "By the way," he added casually, "I had a lot of time to think up there on Indian Peak. Some of your religion must have rubbed off on me after all. One of these days I have some questions about God and stuff." Jack's heart bounced. He started to speak, but Bill beat him to it. "Not now." His yawn came perilously close to dislocating his jaw. "I'm so beat nothing you might say would sink in." "I know the feeling," Jack laughed. "I slept 12 hours straight last night. I think I'll wait for Dad and ride home with him. I've walked my share this summer." Bill was asleep before Jack got to the gate. Jack glanced back at his friend, noticing the different look on his relaxed face. He seemed more mature. He could hardly wait to tell Bill some of the things he'd learned this summer about God. He had a feeling Bill would understand them. Now. "It's a good thing you came home," Mary grinned at the supper table. "How come?" Jack passed his plate for another big piece of Mom's good cornbread. "'Course you'd have missed your supper." Mary's words came through a mouthful of salad. "Don't talk with your mouth full," Mom admonished. She looked rested and happy. Jack's homecoming and Dad's being back at work showed in her tender, smiling face. Mary persisted. "You wouldn't be able to see our signal." "That's right." Jack put down his knife, remembering that time when he hadn't seen the signal. A little of the fear that paralyzed him then brushed against him even in the warmly lighted room. When the meal was over, he slipped quietly outside and stood in the spot Mary had showed him earlier, where the family had faithfully gathered each night at 6 o'clock. It was six now. Some impulse made Jack steal to the woodshed, where the white signal flag still hung forgotten on its long pole. He checked the house. Good. No one was watching. He didn't want his family to see what he was doing. He wouldn't be able to explain, even to himself. A great lump grew in his throat. The dark bulge that was Mount Chinook no longer looked lonely or unfriendly. The bright stars shone peacefully on the now deserted lookout site, as if God smiled. "Goodbye, summer of fear." Jack lifted the final 6 o'clock signal flag and waved it into the darkness. The end.